Well, a number of significant international events taking place, at least in the last few weeks, not just Afghanistan, but elsewhere as well. Joining us to comment on at least some of them, Scott Lucas, founder, editor of EA Worldview, Professor, University of Birmingham, UK, joining us live from the UK this evening. Good evening, Scott Lucas.
Good evening and salam alaikum.
Thank you for joining us. Walaikum salam, Professor. You know, Professor Scott, give us a worldview, of course, on a number of events that seem to be catching, you know, headlines, or at least the first or the second page of news headlines. What should we look for from the UN General Assembly? UN General Assembly looking to meet in, you know, in the next a few days or so. What are we looking to for them to comment on?
Well, from, you know, my standpoint, and I think probably from the standpoint of many people in South Africa and around the world, what we would look for is effective discussion on issues that concern us all, such as climate change, which is already having a tremendous effect on our lives. Issues such as the coronavirus pandemic, specifically trying to get vaccines, not just to the wealthier countries, but to all countries. And broader issues about inequality, you know, trying to get development for all. But what happens at the UN quite often is that rather than these transnational, international issues, we get national posturing. So I fear that, for example, you will get the Iranians going, look at us, we stand up against America, and the Saudis saying, we stand up against the Iranians. We may get, you know, the whole U.S. versus China narrative, you know, possible confrontation. And in this, even this idea of basically national interest, that each national leader is trying to say either America first or Moscow first or Beijing first, rather than, hey, it should be all of us first.
Mm. You know, Professor Scott, I don't know how the world is viewing the headlines or the news coming out of Afghanistan. It's been a few weeks now since the formation of the, well, the Taliban government out there, as well as the arrival into Kabul. But one thing that we have struggled with is accurate information coming out of Afghanistan itself. I mean, there's been a plethora of misinformation. Even station reporters from, you know, the mainstream media within the country unable to actually verify many items and many posts that they are able to put. What's happening out of Afghanistan, Professor?
Well, you're right, because many of the stories, even if we get them out of Afghanistan, might be just out of the capital, Kabul, or out of the eastern city of Jalalabad. You know, and Afghanistan's a big country. Beyond that, I probably would say two levels to keep your eyes on. The first is, if you're looking at the national level, look to see if the Taliban are even able at this point to form a government. Now, they have finally, after weeks, named certain ministers, the defense ministry, for example, the interior minister, and indeed the head of government. But there's actually a division within the Taliban between a faction which includes a group called the Haqqani Network, which had been based out of Pakistan, and the group which had been negotiating in the Gulf in the political talks until recently, led by Mullah Baradar. So it's not even a question of what the Taliban are going to do yet economically or socially in a national way, because they really haven't established authority. And then for me, I think the most important thing is, yes, I mean, we do still have contacts in Afghanistan. I'm lucky enough to know people who are still working to try to maintain education, try to maintain communities. And there is a lot of fear. There is a lot of concern. Certainly there are some people who welcome the Taliban, who think they'll bring security to the country. But there are many others who think that the political and social space that they have enjoyed, the ability to get an education, the ability just to simply participate in their communities, will be curbed by the Taliban. And we will see. We'll see when the Taliban govern whether they try to be more inclusive of all Afghans, or whether they are, in fact, similar to the Taliban that we had in the 1990s, that were a very, very restrictive group with what I would call a very radical interpretation of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Professor Scott, I mean, moving on to the Australia-UK-US deal for nuclear-powered submarines. I mean, what is the significance of this? You know, what are we to read? Is this the a new age of, you know, intersharing and nuclear power, or at least military sharing between these three countries?
In a way, I think it's almost an old age of nuclear sharing and military sharing. And by that, I mean, it's the type of alliance which, you know, in some respects is posturing, and let's be honest here, versus China, the idea that there is at least a competition, if not a confrontation, in the Asia-Pacific region. But I think the interesting thing about this is that this announcement by these three countries may be an old form of alliance which is obsolete and even counterproductive. Because look at what has happened in the next few days. The other Asian allies, Indonesia, Malaysia, have come out against this. Japan has effectively called up to Europe to work with it, feeling it's been isolated by the effectively Anglo-Saxon powers. And South Korea, where do they go next in this, you know, competition or uncertain atmosphere in the Pacific? And then, of course, the effect on the U.S. with European allies is significant, because the way that this was done, with the three countries not even informing the French, who had the submarine contract with Australia, a contract worth $66 billion, the French, it's not just a question they feel snubbed. There is, I think, the very real possibility of a European defense bloc being established for the first time since the 1940s that is not just following the United States. It was signaled last week by the European Union head, Ursula von der Leyen, that they want a European defense bloc. We could be entering a 21st century world, which is very different from the alliances and connections of that we had in the 20th century until recently.
Hmm. Russian elections having concluded over the course of the weekend, Professor Scott, and opponents accusing Russian authorities of mass fraud. Although, you know, sometimes in these Russian elections, it seems like a broken record. Somebody's going to accuse somebody of something. In this case here, mass fraud, and you know, with the party that's quite openly pro Putin having won, you know, expectedly by many people. What are we to make of the Russian elections?
Well, let me try to be diplomatic. I think even Mr. Putin might accept that this was, let's call it, a managed election. You don't have to look at the reports in the last 24 hours for months, and especially in recent weeks. Opposition parties have been shut out of the elections, not allowed to participate. Those parties who did participate, there's been a clampdown on social media. There were even Apple and Google were even threatened by the Kremlin to block certain apps before the election, apps which simply said, here are the candidates who are running in certain areas. There is extensive evidence of ballot stuffing and of massaging the figures. Does this mean that Mr. Putin and his United Russia Party have no support? Of course not. They quite likely would have won the most votes, albeit a plurality, not a majority of the votes. But the figures will be massaged, because it's not just a question of what happens today. The political environment in Russia, there's an elite at the top which has gradually tightened the number of people who are there, who are involved in the Kremlin, in the Duma, in the parliament, because Vladimir Putin, let us be honest here, is trying to set up a system where he can be the leader until 2036. There is still an opposition in Russia. But increasingly, that's an opposition that you won't see through the elections. You will see it as they try to make efforts, even as social media is being clamped down, to say we're still here. Because remember, it's not just a political issue. The Russian economic system is extremely weak. It's effectively a kleptocracy now, and it benefits the few rather than the many. So that issue will not go away.
Moving on to Iran joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. First, you know, Professor Scott, before we talk of the significance of Iran joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, I mean, what is this about? China's attempt to create some sort of a network of trade and diplomacy in that area? And how strong is it from a global platform?
It's part of the Chinese initiative to project an alternative economic system, and you might say an alternative political system, or at least one that coexists with sort of that more Western-led system we've had for, 75 years. It includes many of the former Soviet republics, such as Tajikistan, such as Uzbekistan. It includes Russia, and significantly includes Pakistan and India. So it crosses those religious lines. But I think even that story tells you where the tensions are within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, because your listeners will know that India and Pakistan don't necessarily get along that well. And I think Iran's accession, on the one hand, is a symbolic victory for Iran. Look, We're standing up against America. We're standing up against Europe. Look, China and Russia now want to work with us. But on the other hand, China especially knows that, you know, the Iranians don't come into the organization without risk. Iran still has not got a nuclear agreement with other countries, has not been renewed, I should say. Iran is taking a much tougher stance vis-a-vis the United States and indeed the Arab world. And I think China will want an Iran in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that is not just simply thumping its chest, but actually offers economic potential. So does Iran realize that? And will you actually get an organization that indeed is economically strong enough, going beyond Asia and indeed into places like Africa, where it is a true alternative to the international system, international economic system that we've had since 1945?
Professor Scott Lucas, thank you for joining us on Radio Islam International once again. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Peace to you and all your listeners.
Founder, editor of EA Worldview, Professor Scott Lucas, joining us with his opinion and matter about a number of global events taking place. And yes, Russian elections. I know that with our municipal elections around the corner, many people focus less or are focusing less on events taking place elsewhere. But this, from a global perspective, was a significant one in the sense that it ensured, you could say, that Vladimir Putin will at least be around for a long, long time. Allah Ta'ala knows best how long anybody will be around, but at least his party. Remember, Russia is also a party state, not just an individual state, although Mr. Putin in his party seems to be a very, very polarizing figure. You know, like you have this one major politician and everything in the party revolves around him. And Russia is, in fact, a party government or a governance in that way. Well, at least this election ensures that, his party will receive the bulk of the seats, in the election and for the foreseeable future to come, at least for the next 5 years there in Russia. Well, a few minutes before bottom of the hour, it is time for me to conclude the daily roundup. And until we meet again, inshallah, tomorrow, as always, just after Maghrib and our announcements, etc. thereafter,